Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Scholar Stephen R. Shalom joins us this time to talk about U.S. policies in the Middle East. He teaches political science at William Patterson University in New Jersey, where he says he puts the politics back into political science. Among his publications are Imperial Alibis, Rationalizing U.S. Intervention After the Cold War. Stephen R. Shalom also writes for Z Magazine, and you will find his articles on the website for William Patterson University. Professor Shalom, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
You are presently editing a book, Perilous Power, the Middle East, and U.S. Foreign Policy Dialogues on Terror, Democracy, War, and Justice. It's a complicated book. It is a conversation, essentially. Tell us about the book and what the topics are going to be.
It's a conversation between two of the most important experts we have on the modern Middle East, who are both knowledgeable and committed to peace and justice in the region, and that is Noam Chomsky and Gilbert Achkar. They obviously have different experiences, different areas of expertise. They share a commitment to justice, as I said, but come at some of these issues differently. And so they have quite an interesting discussion, often agreeing, sometimes supplementing each other's remarks, and sometimes disagreeing. And that whole conversation is essentially the basis of that book.
Let's turn to some of the narrow coverage from the U.S. of stories relating to Israel and the Palestinians. Talk about the significance of the style and choice in coverage by the U.S. press in terms of what it says about U.S. policy towards the region.
Well, I think most people get the sense that what's going on in Palestine right now is a conflict between two factions of Palestinians, those represented by Mahmoud Abbas, the head of Fatah, and the other group being Hamas. And the impression we get is that one is in favor of some kind of negotiations and peace process, namely the Abbas forces, and the other rejects the notion of a two-state solution. In fact, the truth is that both groups of Palestinians are on record in many different ways indicating their support for a two-state solution. And the real opposition to a two-state solution comes, in fact, from Washington and from Israel. And this has been the case for many, many years. That is, ever since Security Council Resolution 242 in 1967, which said that Israel should withdraw from the occupied territories and that countries should live in peace with one another. The problem with that resolution was it didn't include any mention of Palestinians except as refugees. But by the mid-70s, when the international consensus basically said that Israel should withdraw and on the territories from which Israel has withdrawn, there should be a Palestinian state. Since the mid-70s, the Palestinians have indicated their support for that, and Israel and the United States have rejected it. And even now, with all this talk of Oslo and the peace process and the roadmap, what's clear is that a complete Israeli withdrawal is not accepted either by Israel or by the United States. And much of the negotiations, much of the talk is, what can Israel do to make sure that what is left for the Palestinians doesn't involve a real viable territory that could become the basis of their national existence? So on the West Bank, the water resources are controlled by Israel. The plans that Israel has offered back in 2000 during the Camp David negotiations involved bisecting and trisecting the West Bank into virtually non-contiguous pieces so that, in fact, you couldn't really have a viable existence for a Palestinian state. So the Palestinians and the Arab states in their 2002 statement essentially said, if Israel withdraws from the occupied territories, we are prepared to accept the Palestinian state on the territory that Israel has withdrawn from. And that's not what Israel or the United States are interested in. And so that's where the real obstacle to peace comes from. And when we hear that Sharon withdrew from Gaza as though this was a big step towards Palestinian self-determination. In fact, it was the contrary. It was a unilateral step taken to leave the Palestinians with a piece of territory without sovereignty, with tremendous economic deprivation and hardship, which was territory Israel didn't want. That is, Israel doesn't really want to rule over Palestinians. What Israel wants is the Palestinian land and resources. And so if you can squash Palestinians into the hellhole that is Gaza and into areas of dense Palestinian population in the West Bank and keep all the rest and the resources, et cetera, for Israel, that's what Israeli policymakers have wanted for a long time, and it doesn't represent a just or a fair solution. So when we're focusing on this conflict, this fighting between Hamas and Fatah, what's going to happen to the peace process? The key thing to keep in mind is that the peace process has been torpedoed for a very long time by Israel and its supporters in the United States, that is the U.S. government, which has enabled Israel to reject peace for so long.
Back in 2002, you spoke before the New York City Council, and you said that in your view, any resolution from that council about the tragic conflict between Israelis and Palestinians ought to aim for two goals. First, it should express itself in terms of universal moral principles, rather than in terms of the parochial interests of one group or another. And second, you said, it should help to move the long-suffering people of the Middle East closer to, rather than further from, peace and justice. Talk about that 2002 statement you made in terms of where we are today.
Well, at the time, the New York City Council was considering a resolution that would eject the PLO from its UN offices in New York City. And this kind of thing comes up every so often in New York as a matter of sort of ethnic politics in New York City and has very little to do with ultimate questions of justice. It seems to me that if the New York City Council or any body, any group, is going to take a position on the Middle East, they ought to take a position that is morally consistent. That is, to be sure, terrorism by Palestinians should be condemned, but likewise, terrorism by the Israeli state and Israeli state forces should be condemned as well. And in addition, when Israeli terrorist acts are done with the help of helicopters provided by the United States or Caterpillar bulldozers provided by the United States, then the criminal involvement of those U.S. corporations and the U.S. government needs to be condemned as well. That is, there are lots of human rights violations going on in the region, and to focus on those of the weaker party only and to ignore those of the stronger party seems to me extremely morally inconsistent.
Turning now to some of the headlines on the Middle East, as world attention turned to Israeli rocket attacks, gruesome civilian casualties on a Palestinian beach, we heard some of the remarks of the Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, who said, quote, the IDF is the most moral military in the world. There never has been, he said, and there isn't now, a policy of attacking civilians. Just talk about what is said by Israel when Palestinian civilians are killed by these types of attacks.
Yeah, well, I mean, his statement is a statement that has been made by Israeli officials and Israeli apologists since the founding of the state, that they were a righteous army and therefore, almost by definition, never engaged in human rights abuses or atrocities of any kind. And in fact, as we now know, and it's been documented very well by Israeli historians, among others, ever since the beginning, that is, before 1948 even, there were attacks by the Irgun, but also by the Haganah, against Palestinian civilians. And these have been well documented, you know, despite the claims by the Israeli government. And this has gone right up to the present. The attacks on Beirut in 1982, those were clearly meant to terrorize civilians. We routinely hear that when some terrorist has been said to come from some refugee camp, Israeli warplanes will bomb the refugee camp. Now, who do you think you're bombing when you're bombing refugee camps? They're not able to find a particular terrorist and hit him. They're hitting refugees, and their intent is, just as with terrorism generally, that if you can cause enough harm to civilians, this might put enough pressure on policymakers to change the policy. That's what all terrorists try to do, that is, essentially use civilians as a way to obtain a change in policy, and that's something we condemn, or something that we ought to condemn, but strangely, the condemnation rarely seems to apply to Israel. Israelis don't wrap bombs around their waists and go into Palestinian pizzerias. But on the other hand, Israelis shoot missiles into apartment buildings in order to get one person, not caring about all the other civilians living in the building, even assuming that that one person indeed deserves to be killed in that way rather than captured and put on trial. It's indeed reason to think the person is guilty of crime.
Here is another comment that Ehud Olmert made, quote, "Hamas did not start operating this past weekend." Talk about the irony of that comment, given the origins of Hamas itself.
Well, back in the late 1980s, there was a Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupying forces. This was the first Intifada. And it was largely a nonviolent, unarmed uprising. I mean, there were kids throwing rocks and so on. But in the face of that, Israeli forces used lethal force. Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin called for the breaking of the bones of Palestinians, and it was a brutal repression by the Israeli security forces. And it was in that atmosphere that Hamas arose, sort of critical of the nonviolence and of the nonviolent response to Israeli repression. And so, yes, Hamas didn't begin yesterday, but they arose precisely as a result of Israeli repression, and brutal repression at that, of a nonviolent resistance movement.
Now, less than 2 weeks before George Bush arrived in Baghdad unexpectedly to shake the hand of Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister there, the prime minister himself was declaring states of emergency in Iraq, in Basra. And there have been U.S. forces moving in very heavily in Ramadi, according to Dar Jamail, someone we've just had on Talk Nation Radio. We have a heavy-handedness once again in the policy being enacted. Let's look at that aspect of things where the U.S. answer to difficulties in Iraq has been to either withdraw and let chaos occur, leave things in the hands of the Iraqi security forces as they are, or move in en masse and use heavy-handed tactics that kill civilians, wound them, or send them fleeing.
This is the problem. It's not easy to be a colonial or neo-colonial ruler. Often, no strategy works well, and that's why it's one of the reasons why colonialism and neo-colonialism are not good things and why conquest is not a good thing. In the case of U.S. military strategy in Iraq, it really seems to be counterproductive in many respects. When you kill some enemy by dropping a 500-pound bomb on him, you cause enough collateral damage so that you probably drive 10 times as many people to sign up with the guerrillas as the number you killed. Just to give you one indication of the number of civilians the United States has killed, in 2005, the U.S. spent $20 million on what they called condolence payments. These are for deaths, injuries, or property damage caused by U.S. action. Now, most of the deaths caused by the United States, you can assume the U.S. didn't pay anything for, because the U.S. routinely denies responsibility. And you remember that first year when the U.S. bombed a wedding, and then they were shown, look at all these, the bride and groom dressed up in their wedding outfits, they're blown to smithereens. And so the U.S. response was, guerrillas can have weddings too, therefore this was a legitimate target. So if you just take the number that the U.S. is acknowledging were wrongfully killed, they're paying $20 million. If you assume that the maximum payment for death, which the U.S. gives, is $2,500 per death, that's 8,000 deaths in 2005 alone, and those are the ones the U.S. admits. And I assume those have got to be a small fraction of the actual ones. And the point is that every one of those deaths is likely to cause more people to want to join guerrilla or terrorist organizations. And so if your goal is to calm things down, U.S. tactics of airstrikes, missile strikes and so on are in fact likely to have the opposite effect. That is, they're likely to make the situation worse.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Let's talk about goals, because it does seem that some of what the White House is doing in terms of policy lately has much more to do with the upcoming congressional elections and with the 2008 presidential elections and where the parties stand. If we look at immigration policy, INS has just cracked down and arrested 2,000 immigrants. We are seeing heavy-handedness there. The policies in Israel towards the Palestinians have been to use airstrikes, very heavy-handed attacks on Palestinians because of the election that brought Hamas to power. And now in Iraq, we are again seeing these heavy-handed policies of calling in air support, hitting the streets with more troops, and perhaps now doing in Ramadi what was done in Fallujah, which is literally to remove the civilian population one way or another through airstrikes or through forcing them out by using so much, you know, military might in the cities.
You know, the Fallujah in 2004 wasn't election-driven. In fact, the attack was done really after the election because the thought was that this might not look good for someone who had just said things were going peachy keen in Iraq to suddenly have this major conflict. But I think you're right that in general, U.S. policy in Iraq is not strictly based on what's working or not working in Iraq. A lot of it is based on how is it going to play in the United States. And this is where the role of the Democrats comes in. When the Democrats offer no alternative to the policy of the Bush administration, if they essentially have a Hillary Clinton kind of policy, then there's no pressure on the administration at all to change or do anything that it's not been doing. That is, that it has essentially a free hand. To the extent that some Democrats have been able to put forward an alternative policy, you know, Mirtha and Barbara Boxer and now Kerry, this at least begins to make this an issue, put it on the public agenda in the United States, and therefore make things more difficult for the administration. But, you know, I think the conflict that's going on within the Democratic Party now will decide, really, to use Bush's language, whether it's going to be relevant or irrelevant. This is what he said about the UN. But the Democrats will be irrelevant if they don't have an alternative point of view.
Can you articulate a good response to someone who asks what will happen to the civilian population of Iraq, let's say, first, if the U.S. forces withdraw? And then, two, what would happen if Israel and the U.S. and other countries lent support to Hamas and let the elected government of the Palestinian people lead the Palestinian people? In other words, how can we respond to questions about what happens if we change the policies, what happens to the people involved in these countries?
In Iraq, no one can be sure what's going to happen if the U.S. withdraws. Each year that has gone by, the situation has gotten worse and worse. So the presence of U.S. troops has, rather than calming tensions in the country, made them worse. It may be that civil war is inevitable in the country. I don't know. But what I do know is that the presence of the U.S. there isn't making things any better. And that's why when you look at public opinion polls and you ask Iraqis, who do you count on for your security? I mean, some talk about the police, some talk about the army, a small number talk about the resistance, and a number that talk about U.S. forces, or you know, the multinational forces, as they're euphemistically called, tends to be less than 1%. That was a poll done by the International Republican Institute. So it's not at all clear to me that if you're concerned about the well-being of Iraqis, keeping the U.S. presence there is the way to go. We do know that a group that's very influential with the resistance, the Association of Muslim Scholars, has said if the United States were to have a timetable for withdrawal, they didn't even say, you know, a full withdrawal, but just a timetable for withdrawal, they would issue a fatwa calling on all armed actions to cease. Now, I don't mean to suggest that they have the influence to be able to get everyone to lay down arms, but they're very influential with the Sunni resistance, not with the, you know, the foreign Zarqawi types, but with the Sunni resistance that has created sort of a pond of resistance within which the Zarqawi types have been able to breed. And so it seems to me that without the U.S. there, the incentives are in the right direction for getting Iraqi forces to come to some kind of settlement. As long as the United States is present, the incentives are in the opposite direction. Because now the incentive is, we don't have to worry about somehow bringing all the forces in our country together. We've got the U.S. here to defend us, so we can do what we want. So it seems to me that the sentiments of Iraqis is for a U.S. withdrawal. The sentiment of Iraqis says that the American presence is not what's protecting them. There's good reason to think that with the U.S. out, the incentives on Iraqis to come to some kind of settlement will be much stronger than it is when the U.S. is present. Will those incentives be enough to prevent civil war? I can't say that with any confidence, but clearly the record of the last few years is that the presence of the United States has not helped to reduce civil war either. Now let's turn to the question of Palestine. Hamas has a number of extreme positions, and it's clearly in everyone's interest that they adopt more pragmatic policies. But the approach of Israel and the United States has been that rather than trying to encourage more pragmatic policies from Hamas, we're going to punish them for not having such policies. And the punishment has two or three consequences. One is that it has horrendous consequences for the Palestinian people in terms of denial of medical care and so on and so forth. The second is that it's leading to deep fissures in Palestinian society. And this is not the kind of fissure that, you know, well, this is what you got to go through, but in the end, a good result will emerge. No, if you drive Hamas from office by denying them funding and so on, the result is likely to be that they will feel cheated of their electoral victory and will turn to an all-out military confrontation, and that's in nobody's interest. The U.S. and Israel are helping Mahmoud Abbas to build up larger security forces, which essentially means not the security forces under the control of the elected parliament. So they're essentially building up a contending power center that can make a civil war more likely. That seems to me incredibly dangerous. I don't think poverty and despair lead to moderation. And that's essentially the approach that's being taken. Let's starve them. Let's starve the Palestinian people. And they will then demand a more moderate government. I'm not sure that's what they'll demand. It seems to me that this policy that Israel and the United States and to a lesser extent the Europeans are following is not one that's likely to advance the cause of peace at all.
In terms of wealthy U.S. investors and corporate interests, there does seem to be an attitude underlying some of the processes that we hear a little bit about, that various leaders in the corporate world and some members of Congress don't see an alternative to the status quo because there's so much at stake economically in terms of these policies. Just talk about that aspect.
Well, let's just clarify what we mean when we say there's a lot at stake economically. You could mean one of two things. You could mean that the American people and the American economy, that is every working stiff in the country, depends on the oil from the Middle East in order to get to work and do everything else that a modern society requires. In that sense, the U.S. does not depend on Middle Eastern oil. That is, most U.S. oil now comes from sources in the Western Hemisphere or Nigeria and places like that, from Africa, and not from the Middle East. But there's another sense in which the economic value, the oil of the Middle East, is a crucial resource, not to the average American, but to centers of power and wealth in the country. And that is that whoever controls the Middle East has a stranglehold over the rest of the industrial world. And what that means is that the U.S., by controlling the Middle East, has tremendous leverage over its industrial rivals, over the Germanys and Japans and so on. Back in the 1940s, when the U.S. occupied Japan after World War II, George Kennan, the top U.S. planner, said, by controlling oil, we essentially have a veto over Japanese policy. They can't really take a step without our permission because we can turn off the oil and crush their economy. We've seen that on a minor scale between Russia and the Ukraine because of some conflict. Russia turned off the energy resources for a while and put pressure on Ukraine. Well, if the U.S. has a dominant position in the Middle East, what this means is that Germany and Japan, which don't have their own access to oil, would be dependent on the good wishes of the U.S. government. And that puts important sectors in the United States in a very strong position. So there's a tremendous economic stake in U.S. domination of the Middle East, but it's not the economic stake of, you know, an American who's worried about oil cut off and won't be able to get to work. Rather, it's the economic stake of essentially world domination, which is wanted only by certain sectors of U.S. society, namely those that are wealthy and powerful.
And so if we as Americans demand a withdrawal from Iraq and changes with other policies we've talked about here, are we up against the Bush administration and that group of other interests that want the policies to go forward too? And if we are, how do we approach that and be hopeful?
Well, they're going to certainly say that they're going to pretend it's not their narrow interests, but they're going to pretend this is the interest of the American people as a whole. Okay? And this is a standard practice that the powerful and the wealthy always do. So when Bush has his tax cut program, he doesn't say the truth, namely, this is a program to transfer vast resources from the American people as a whole to the top 0.1% of my campaign supporters. He doesn't say that. What he says is, this is not the government's money, it's your money, so I'm returning it to all of you, you know, and so on and so forth. Okay. And no doubt he will try the same thing about, you know, talking about the importance of the Middle East. He won't say, we need the Middle East because that allows the dominant state sector in the United States to control the global economy so that we can have leverage over our industrial rivals. No, he's going to say, I got a letter from so-and-so from Peoria, and she wants to be able to get to work tomorrow in her car, and so on and so forth. Now, one advantage we have is that it's going to be hard for Bush with a straight face to be able to say that he's doing things for the good of the American people who need their oil when, under his watch, the price of oil, the price of gasoline at the pump has more or less doubled. That gives progressives an opening because we can point to the obvious contradictions in the claims of the Bush administration. They don't care about the average American's access to energy. That's not what they're doing. If they cared about that, you know, we wouldn't see the policies we're now seeing. They think of ways of imposing stiff excess profit taxes on the oil companies. But, of course, that's the furthest thing from the minds of the Bush administration because they're obviously in the pockets of the energy companies and adequately bought off through their campaign contributions. So we do have an opening. The Bush administration and apologists for it will no doubt try very hard to make it seem as though it's not a narrow interest of the rich that's at stake, but an interest of all of us. But that's something that's been going on for centuries. The rich always do that. You know, that's our job, to try to refute that misleading argument.
Professor Stephen R. Shalom teaches political science at William Paterson University in New Jersey. He is presently editing a book that is essentially a conversation between Noam Chomsky and Gilbert Achkar. It is to be published by Paradigm Publishers in the fall. Our conversation continues in upcoming programs as Stephen R. Shalom tells us more about U.S. policy in the war on terror, Iraq, and Palestine. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m., TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion within the new cafe.